From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. We kick off our Irish Fest coverage today with a look at Irish spirituality in place, word, and deed. Plus, this year features the distinctive traditional music of Nova Scotia.
This fiddle style basically mimics the sound of the bagpipes, influenced by the Gaelic language, but at the same time, there's nothing that's absolutely pure. It's something that has very much been influenced by pockets of Irish and pockets of Acadian settlement.
But there'll also be plenty of Irish music, too, from England and Ireland, by way of Disney World.
So many songs and tunes now that we do play. It's hard. The set in Milwaukee probably only for an hour, so...
Yeah, we've been playing 4 hours a night for probably 5 years, you know, six nights a week. So we're going to be finished by the time we warm up.
Yeah, so...
And we'll hear about a new book about a remarkable Wisconsin woman and her life of faith. Stay tuned for Lake Effect. News is first. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company. Milwaukee's Irish Fest starts tonight, and after 30 years, it's more than just one of the city's most popular ethnic festivals. It's recognized as the largest celebration of Irish culture, music, and heritage in North America. And it makes sense the event's held here, because Irish immigrants once dominated the city's Third Ward, and it was one of the largest immigrant groups to Wisconsin in the mid-19th century. Thousands of people go for the music, but there's also a large educational component that's already underway at the Irish Fest Summer School. Julianne Donnellan is teaching two courses in Irish spirituality. She's a native of Ireland who now works for the Diocese of Green Bay. She tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce why, amid the festival's food and feasting, it's also important to talk about faith.
It's important not to ignore the full aspect of what it means to be Irish, and our huge cultural gift to the world in terms of art and jewelry making and storytelling has all flowed, if you look at the history of Ireland, from the faith of the Irish people. A number of events shaped the consciousness of the Irish people. Pre-Christian Ireland, Christian Ireland, and particularly St. Patrick, who we remember every year, but also the oppression the Irish suffered under the hands of the British, and particularly with the penal laws and the famine. And if you look at those particular events for people, they tend to be very evocative and are associated not just with places, but with stories that might have been passed down from one generation to another. And so if you want to understand the Irish, you have to understand good story. And many of the stories of the Irish also have a strong faith component that it's important to look at too.
You talked about the importance of stories and understanding the role of faith and of understanding the Irish ability to get through struggle. Is this where learning about Irish spirituality goes beyond just an interest in Ireland and its culture and becomes a more universal topic?
Absolutely. I think two huge parts of the legacy of Ireland that people of any faith tradition can take with them is hospitality. The mandate for hospitality is a huge part of our culture, and our storytelling culture has kind of become, you know, world-renowned for, you know, having a sense of a sacred space and understanding that in a person that you've never met before, in a stranger, you will surely become friends if you sit down at the table together and share a cup of tea and some bread. So I like that aspect of the faith, and that comes out a lot. The other aspect is that the Irish were so convicted of having such a center on Christ's love in their life that they wanted to share that with the world. And so it took the form of manuscripts and jewelry making. And so a lot of the jewelry that you'll see, for example, at Irish Fest, has a strong symbolism associated with it, which when people look at it, they don't often understand. That might be a Trinity knot, that might be a Celtic love knot. And all of those would have come out of that Celtic tradition of metalworking. But initially, it was a desire to share people's love of faith and what they felt about meaning and where they were going in life. And you see that very much amongst the burial tombs of Ireland as well. Newgrange is a great example of an ancient people desiring to share with the world a story. Where are we going? Why are we here? Is there more to life? Those are all questions every people, regardless of where they are in their faith life or where they are around the world, can share. We've all dialogued with those questions too.
Break down for us what we see when we see these kinds of Irish icons in popular culture and whether they actually have pre-Christian or Christian or faith-based roots.
Well, your listeners might be familiar with, for example, the triple spiral. And so the triple spiral is known as the Triskelion in art, and it's represented on ancient tombs in Ireland, probably one of the most famous being Newgrange. Now, the Newgrange tombs in County Meath in Ireland actually are older than the Great Pyramids of Egypt. So you're talking, you know, thousands upon thousands of years old. Now, that triple spiral is actually the three cycles of life that every woman goes through, but also the cycles of the earth go through. Pre-fertility comes first. Then there's fertility, where the land is capable of generating forth new life. And then there's post-fertility, where you're on the latter end of your life, so to speak, and things are dying off. And that's a symbol that most people have come to realize as the Trinity, the Father, Son, and Spirit. But the older roots of that symbol, which are 2,000 or 3,000 years old, predate Christianity, and actually speak to that beautiful premise that all women live their lives on, pre-fertility, fertility, and post-fertility, maiden, mother, crone. And so that symbol has come to mean Trinity in our minds, but it's actually much older and points to the earth and also the goddesses, Morrigan being one of the most famous. So that's a symbol that a lot of people would have been very, very familiar with, and I think it's probably the most famous symbol of Ireland. Another symbol that you see in Ireland is, of course, the Celtic cross. Now, the Celtic cross was introduced to Ireland in the 400s to about the 1200s was the high point of the monastic life, the golden age of Ireland. But the ring around the cross, well, the development of the ring points to the sun. And the pre-Christian Celts throughout all the nations worshipped the sun. Now, when the early saints saw that and St. Patrick saw that, they looked at that symbol and they saw, you know, the polytheistic, which means worshipping many gods, sun-worshipping people. And so they wanted to Christianize that. And St. Patrick rings the Celtic cross with the sun. So the sun represents Christ, the true sun who will never die. Because, of course, the Celts were very afraid of the winter because the sun declined and the land perished during the winter months. And they were very, very afraid that the sun wouldn't come back again. So, you know, you had this fear of the sun, and St. Patrick introduced the sun as the love of Christ, which was a symbol that, of course, has become synonymous with Ireland now, the Celtic cross.
Do you see specifically in Wisconsin some of these cultural remnants of Irish faith here, given that we had so many Irish immigrants in the mid-19th century?
In terms of the worship, there's some very interesting churches throughout the state. And there's a church in Green Bay called St. Patrick's, of course, St. Patrick's. But when you go in, you'll notice that the crucifix has an image of Christ on the cross. And I went in, and the first time I saw that, I thought, boy, that image of Christ looks remarkably like an Irishman. And one of the historians at the church told me, oh, it was carved in Ireland, and so it looks like an Irish version of Jesus. And so that's in one of our churches here. There's also some beautiful stained glass windows which depict not just Irish saints, but little flowers and some of the flora and fauna of Ireland throughout the state. And I'm always surprised and really excited when I get to go to a new community where there's a St. Patrick's Church or a St. Killian Church, for example, and they have some beautiful and very old depictions of the saints as they're found in Ireland for the Irish communities that developed there. Of course, you have the big St. Patrick's Day festival. That, I think, Milwaukee is well famous for. But a lot of communities throughout Wisconsin and the smaller church communities would still have a special mass around St. Patrick's Day and a special meal for the community as a way to remember their Irish roots. And so you do see the kind of tentacles of Irish culture kind of permeating through Wisconsin in probably ways that people take for granted and probably don't reflect on as much as it as we could probably, because it's so numerous and it's so much a part of the development of this state actually has been the contribution of the Irish.
There's so much more to Irish faith than just St. Patrick and celebrating St. Patrick's Day. Is that one of the challenges you face in your talks?
Absolutely, and that's one of the great things about the summer school and actually Irish Fest is giving teachers such as myself the opportunity to share with people the real, real parts of Ireland and the real faith and the real culture and real historical traditions of the Irish. One tradition that I shared with my class this morning that really touched some of their hearts was, I asked many people in the class, do you put a candle in the window at Christmas, for example? Several people said, yeah, my mother always did that, or I've carried that on. I said, do you know where that came from? many people said, no, but my granny, my great-grandmother from Ireland did this. Well, there's three reasons, for example, that the candle is put in the window at Christmas. One is to welcome the Holy Family, who found no room at any inn. And so you put the candle in the window to say, we have room in our heart, in our home here for the Holy Family, if you were to pass by tonight. The second one is, during the penal laws, which were enacted during the 16th and 17th and 18th centuries in Ireland, they were laws that oppressed not just the faith of the Irish, but the Irish language itself, and sought to really eradicate the person of the Irish. So, for example, the penal laws would put to death priests. People were convicted if they were caught with a cross or a rosary bead. And if you were found speaking your natural language, in your native language, which was Gaelic, you could be killed for that. And so a candle was put in the window during the penal times to let the priests or nuns or any Christian on the run from the British government know that they could find a safe house. And then the third reason the candle was put in the window was to welcome and remind all immigrants that there is a candle in the window for everyone who has ever left Ireland. And in the history of Ireland, our unfortunate statistic is that one out of every two people have left Ireland. Our immigration rate has been 50%, and sometimes it's been above that. And so I said to the class this morning, we are all children of immigrants living here. That's a cultural custom that you can do that which has a strong faith-based component as a way to link you to your past. It's challenging when people sometimes associate that all that happens with Ireland is St. Patrick, green beer, and probably drinking, dancing, and fighting. But there's such a rich history, intellectually, culturally, and spiritually to the Irish. So when you understand, for example, a place like Ballintubber Abbey, where St. Patrick was, it's a beautiful place to visit. But until you understand what Patrick did there, and the fact that that abbey has stood for 800 years since 1216, been burned down three times, and still stands, that gives you a different appreciation of it. And so I try and share in my classes some of those aspects of faith and culture and history that all mingle together into this delicious stew where people can really taste a bit of the real Ireland.
Well, Julianne Donlan, thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
Irish native Julianne Donlan is the Director of Adult Faith Formation for the Diocese of Green Bay. She'll teach two classes at the Milwaukee Irish Fest Summer School on Sacred Spaces and Holy Places of Ireland, an Introduction to Celtic Spirituality. There's more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect, and Donlan spoke with Stephanie Lecce. Coming up next, an Irish Milwaukee mother's faith leads her to the slums of Columbia. Her story is being told in the Irish Fest Cultural Village over the weekend. We'll hear about it next when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. One of the great parts of Irish Fest is the way it reconnects Milwaukeeans to their Irish heritage and features city residents of Irish descent. This year, that'll include a Catholic Milwaukee mother who spent decades working in the barrios of Bogota, Colombia. Ma Mary McCormick led efforts to reach the poor alongside her children and other lay and religious missionaries. Among them was Don Miller, now retired as director of the World Mission Office in Milwaukee. McCormick also inspired people back in Milwaukee to help the less fortunate, like Jackie Maggiore. She and Miller teamed up to tell McCormick's story in the new book, Fluent in Faith, The Gift of Mary McCormick. They'll be doing readings and giving talks about the book at Irish Fest's Literary Corner this weekend. Maggiore tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce how McCormick's early life influenced her view on the poor.
Well, first of all, Mary was raised on a farm in a large family in Wisconsin. And she grew up during the time of terrible drought, so that actually the family was practically starving. So they really experienced the lack of food and tremendous struggle, which forced them actually to leave the farm and move into the big city, which she was about 11 when they came here to Milwaukee. So she witnessed and lived through that kind of a struggle. Even though she still remembered the beauty of the farm and the beauty of, you know, living in the country, that was her earliest experience. And then later, because she was widowed at a very young age with seven children and taking care of other children as well, she experienced, you know, the strain of living on almost no budget during the time of the Depression and during World War II and following that. So it was difficult.
What did Mary rely on to get through these difficult times?
Part of it was her intelligence. Mary was a very bright person and very inquisitive. Well, she had this deep interest in learning. And I think that has really, that's one of his characteristics that I think throughout her life really opened up opportunities, and she turned it into something that helped her to help others. When she got to Columbia, her creativity in terms of dealing with what most of us would consider very, very difficult situations was there was always a way to do it, or at least she'd try it. And she had also a unique gift of relating to people, of focusing on people. That was Mary's attitude. You know, she was focused on that person who was in front of her. And when she went into the barrios, she just listened intensely.
She's a single mom with still three young girls living at home with her, and she just up and decides to become a missionary in Colombia. Tell us about how she made that decision.
Well, she went to church very often. She lived right across the street from the church, and she was there one afternoon while her children were in school and praying, and then she saw this memo on the bulletin board saying, in case you're interested in being a missionary in Latin America, come to these sessions. And she saw that, and she said, well, I'm going to take this. It's just interesting. I don't think it's for me, but I'll just take it and look at it. And that was the beginning. She started to go to the sessions. But when I heard that, I said, well, that goes back to her younger years. She always had this fascination with Latin America. Mm-hmm. Some of her daughters had traveled abroad and studied abroad, and so she had this world view as well. For example, during the Vietnam War, she had this map in the kitchen, and they would follow the evening news, and she would kind of plot where the fighting was going on and all these things. So she had a tremendous sense of the world around her, and I think that also helped her to even open up herself. But she had this also, another quality was that she was very daring, I mean tremendously daring, and also very able to respect her children in a unique way. I think most of us parents are more protective of our children, where she somehow or other felt her children would fend for themselves. She was there as a loving caretaker of a sense, but she loved them, but she let them experience life, and that was a tremendous quality that she had. So that's one reason why she could even consider doing that for three children, because I think for her, actually, the initial invitation was that her third youngest daughter wanted to study in Latin America. And so I think Mary saw that, oh, this is an opportunity now for me to realize these dreams that I've had for years.
She admired Dorothy Day so much that I think even before she found this little brochure that invited you to be a lay missioner in Latin America, that she had this desire to be doing more, always to be doing more. And it just seemed natural to her to take this leap. It didn't seem so natural to anybody else, including some of her brothers who would say, you can't do that and take these young girls. And she's, I'm doing it, you know.
How did Mary first get involved with working with the people in the barrio?
Well, in terms of the barrio, that wasn't her first approach. I mean, the initial story when she arrived in Bogota, I mean, here is a woman, didn't know any Spanish at all, 56 years old. Through a Colombian friend, she had heard about this hotel. And so she gets there with her three young daughters, and they're just amazed, this old kind of stuffy hotel. But there were only men there. And to short circuit the story, I mean, it was actually had turned into a brothel. And
welcome to Colombia, right?
Welcome to Colombia.
With your daughters.
Yeah. Yes. And so she did have another contact in Colombia who she ended up contacting, and he was able to, within a day, get her out of there. And they ended up into this one apartment, which, you know, some people say it's coincidence. We sometimes call it God incidents, because it was the connection, because right next door was this home, this person who had a what they call in Spanish, internado, was a school for girls. And so she started to work there with her daughters, and she was teaching English there. That was her first thing. But she loved to discover, and so she was out walking one day, and she actually got lost and ended up into these barrios. Her first work was to work with a daycare center. Most of the women were working as day maids in the houses of the rich. So these mothers either would lock their children in their homes when they were gone. This was a need that they had, was somebody to take care of their children. Or maybe they had a neighbor who would take care of them. But there was a tremendous amount of distrust between the neighbors because these people had moved from the rural areas of Colombia into the city, and this is the only place they could find to live. These people had built shacks, and almost all the shacks were one room. Most of them didn't have many windows, if they had any windows, and a whole family would stay in that one room. We call them shacks because they were made out of wood or any other materials that they could put together just to keep the rain out. That was initially how she got into the barrio.
You talked about how the neighbors in the barrios, without some of these programs, distrusted each other.
Yes.
I wonder, how did Mary gain the trust of the people living there? As a foreigner, as an outsider, how did she gain the trust of these men and women living in squalor, essentially?
Well, one of the ways that she did this was by her astute listening to people. This initial working in the daycare center was a way to kind of start to establish relationships. And when people came and they expressed their needs to Mary, Mary listened, and then she tried to see how could she respond. In late 1971, early 72, she really started to expand her contacts in the barrio. And I think that the thing that ignited this more than anything else was one day when she was visiting this home and she saw this mother having a bottle and nursing her child with something that looked like Coca-Cola. And Mary, who raised seven children of her own, was just astounded. She found out that this was actually sugar water, but this was prior to WIC, or Women, Infants, and Children program here in the United States. But Mary came up with this on her own, this idea of, well, we have to somehow or other give milk to these mothers before they're nursing, while they're still pregnant, and then we have to help them as pregnant women to have safe deliveries and then to provide milk for them for these babies afterwards. Not that she was opposed to breastfeeding, but a lot of these women, because of their poor nutrition, were unable to breastfeed. This was a program that really took off, and that really started to win the confidence of the people. But Mary wasn't just to do this for them. She charged them a little bit. So if it cost a dollar for this bag of milk, she charged 10 cents.
I want to ask about that, because that seemed to be a kind of a running theme, that with all of the programs she set up, I think it was one of her daughters said her mom was interested in not giving just a handout, but a help up.
Right, right. And that was a strong belief of hers, that that it was more important for the person you're serving to have a participation in it and not just a handout. So I'm amazed. I mean, even the milk program is such an example of how she designed it, really. I mean, I'm thinking she initially thought she was going to come back to this country and study social work and get the credentials. She operated without the credentials. She operated with her own natural ability. And so she designed this program where it wound up requiring the parents to continue to be involved, to monitor the infant's weight and after birth and, you know, continued progress. So she set up this whole system to do that. And really based on her belief that you wanted to respect the dignity of the people that you're serving. And she created that very well.
Another aspect of that was she trained these milk captains. She organized the system so that there were milk captains. And these were mainly young women. One of those that I interviewed when I was writing the book was Maria Ines Villamil, and she was a 15-year-old woman that got pregnant and didn't have hardly any study at all. But Mary saw her capacity as a leader, and so she said, you know, if you want to be a milk captain, you have to continue your studies. And so that pushed Maria to study for herself. And these milk captains then would make sure that the people paid their fees, but also that they were taking care of their children. So Mary would go into the barrio only a couple of days a week, but these were women who were neighbors, And then they could oversee and help their neighbors. And that was a dynamic that, you know, affirmed these women, but also gave them an impetus to even be better at what they're doing. This particular woman, this was 30 years ago that she started this, and she told me, "I cannot live a day without doing something for someone else because Mary taught me that."
Well, Don Miller and Jackie Majore, thank you both so much for coming in and telling us Mary McCormick's story.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jacqueline Maggiore and Don Miller are co-authors of Fluent in Faith, The Gift of Mary McCormick. Jackie will be doing a reading followed by a signing on Friday just before 6 at the Literary Corner. Don will be doing the same at 12:30 on Saturday afternoon. On Sunday, they'll be presenting in the Theater Pavilion near Literary Corner from 3:45 to 4:15 with a signing to follow. The music of Nova Scotia takes center stage this year at Irish Fest, and coming up next, we'll talk with a Cape Breton fiddler and scholar about what makes the music special. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Every year, Irish Fest features the music of a particular region or style. Last year, it was American bluegrass and how the folk and traditional music of Ireland and Scotland helped to shape it. This year, the microphone turns to Nova Scotia. Nova Scotia means New Scotland in Latin, and Scottish musical traditions play a huge part in the trad scene there. But so do Irish, French, and English. And that melting pot has created its own distinct musical sound. Cape Breton fiddler Glenn Graham is one champion of that sound. He's recorded a half a dozen solo albums to great acclaim. We're hearing a tune of his now, but he's also a scholar. His book, The Cape Breton Fiddle, Making and Maintaining the Tradition, came out in 2006, and he's busy pursuing a doctorate in between recording and playing gigs. He joins me on the line now from his home in Halifax, ready to give us some insight. Glenn, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here.
The focus of this year's Irish Fest is Nova Scotian music, and I would say probably the most important instrument in Nova Scotian music is the fiddle. Is that fair?
Well, I suppose I would be biased in saying that. But at least to certain regions of Nova Scotia, you would definitely say that the fiddle is the most common instrument, especially Cape Breton Island, although you do find it, you know, in some of the urban centers, which a lot of people have relocated to, such as Halifax. But for sure, even though people consider the fiddle to be the most common instrument, we have all these accompanying instruments as well that people have been incorporating.
You talk about the accompanying instruments, and one of the things I think of that's particular to Nova Scotian traditional music is the use of the piano.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that is particularly Nova Scotian or Cape Breton, or is that something that was adopted by the immigrants coming over from Ireland and Scotland?
Well, the pianos ended up becoming the most popular accompaniment instrument for the fiddling in general. However, you know, there were preceding instruments such as the pump organ, and before that we had probably anything from just the step dancer's feet to rhythmic things such as knitting needles on the fingerboard of the fiddle. Around the same time I think that the pianos were introduced, you probably saw some guitars coming in as well. It's difficult to say which one was first introduced, but the piano itself did seem to take on being the predominant instrument. Not only that, but the style itself was developed and passed on with this generational evolution, which is quite interesting. And you see certain players that influence the piano style. To bring it to the point now that you can definitely pinpoint that it is something very kind of distinct, that there's a distinctive sound to it within Cape Breton and other parts of Nova Scotia.
And that also is true for the fiddling technique as well. And that's something you've written a book about. The Europeans that came to Nova Scotia to settle were basically Scots and some Irish, English, probably some French. And they brought all their traditions with them. But what defines the Nova Scotian and the Cape Breton fiddle style now? What are we hearing that's different from the kind of fiddling that's happening, say, in Scotland or in Ireland now?
Well, it's such a question that you can really expand on in so many different ways. But first of all, there are still some, I think, distinctly even regional styles within Nova Scotia itself. There's a strong, what we call the old-time tradition that was influenced especially by a player named Don Messer, which you see kind of popular across Canada. But also, as I mentioned, in urban centers such as Halifax and Cape Breton Island and northeastern Nova Scotia, we had this style that was very much brought over and probably dominated by, just strictly because of numbers, the Highland Scottish influence. So this fiddle style basically mimics the sound of the bagpipes, influenced by the Gaelic language. But at the same time, some scholars are certainly pointing out that there's nothing that's absolutely pure. It's something that has very much been influenced by pockets of Irish in Cape Breton and pockets of Acadian settlements as well.
So is there a particular bowing technique? Is it the way the tunes are approached? You know, what makes it a Nova Scotian take on a jig or a reel?
Well, I think you'll notice that there's more of a back and forth, sort of maybe almost like a jagged rhythmic bowing pattern that is most prominent in Nova Scotia, especially Cape Breton. And this differs, I guess, from some of the Irish playing that you'd see with more slurring. You'll also see probably slightly more variations of ornamentation, not among all players, but with certain players, you see it more prominent in Cape Breton, and there's specific techniques that are very common to Cape Breton, such as things we call cuts, but they might call birls, you know, which are similar to rolls, which they do in Irish music. As we say, there are differences and similarities.
Right. It's not like it's completely diverged into something unrecognizable, but that sound is so very particular.
Yeah, it's distinct, and I think one thing that shows how it remained distinct, I guess, from some of the playing in Scotland has to do with the dancing that survived in Cape Breton more so than Scotland, because there were cultural and religious and economic pressures in Scotland that caused the immigrations. And when settlers got over here, they were able to maintain the step dancing, which was essentially lost in Scotland. And however, it has since reemerged due to other dancers going over there and maybe Jews who's just maybe a very slight number of individuals that still had remembered this type of dance after these events had occurred.
Well, it sounds like the traditions that came from the Highlands in Scotland are in some ways more alive in Nova Scotia and Cape Breton just because of what you were saying, that those people were able to maintain the traditions and that perhaps even a little more pure than you might find even in the resurgence of traditional music in the Highlands.
Yes, that's certainly an argument that has been presented in, you know, scholarly discourse, and just if you hear it among certain people, especially in Cape Breton, I guess. But, I mean, having visited Scotland as well, they still have, you know, a very vibrant tradition in itself that I feel that sometimes we have to be careful what we say, because things just kind of, I think, musically evolve just in different ways. But I do know what you're saying, because, as we had mentioned, these pressures that occurred in the Highlands did not occur to such a great extent in Cape Breton. So at least what we're getting is maybe a closer picture to the way things were at the time of immigration in Cape Breton Island, as opposed to, you know, these pressures caused and certain individual violin players caused the fiddle style to change in Scotland to sort of a sleeker, slightly more classically influenced style in certain regions, especially the Northeast. But they just diverge differently and evolve differently, but both are beautiful styles. And I think we all, maybe due to cultural exchange now, more of it that's going on, the back and forth travel, I think that you see the influence, you know, certain fiddlers and musicians influence each other now due to travel. And that's one thing that's great about this, you know, festival such as the Milwaukee Irish Fest.
One of the most important things that happens here is the after-hour sessions, where everyone, all the musicians are sitting down and they're playing until 6 in the morning, trading tunes and trading ideas and just having a good time.
Yes, and, you know, I think that is the essence of these Irish and Scottish traditions, too, is this community-minded thing where it's not so much about planned performance. It's about people sitting down together and really getting to exchange ideas, tunes. So this has been going on for centuries now. So you see this occurring, as you say, after hours in these sessions where, you know, somebody will come home to Nova Scotia with a new tune that they learn from somebody who's over performing from Ireland, for instance. And that tune will be introduced to the tradition and might become a part of the tradition, you know, and last 30 years down the line or something. So it's pretty remarkable what these festivals do. They help, I think, expand people's views of what's available to them musically, but at the same time, it helps them value what they have at home when they come home to perform. So this exchange is really something I think is really great.
Now, how did you get interested in the scholarly aspect of it? Because you performed for a long time and still do.
Well, along with playing music and being interested in sports, I guess, as a youngster, academically speaking, I was always took it relatively seriously, I guess, my academics. Not that I was always studying, because I surely wasn't. But when I got to St. Evex University, I had actually taken political science, but I was playing music at the same time. And as that degree ended, I wanted to pursue my music career for a little while. But I always had in the back of my mind that academically, I would like to be involved with something that still interests me. So I found this really attractive program at St. Mary's University called the Atlantic Canada Studies Program, which allows you to write about anything you wish, really, as long as it had to do with Atlantic Canada Studies. So I thought it was just a great time and a great place to pursue my interests in exploring Cape Breton music from more of a scholarly standpoint than just playing it. And then it just kind of took off from there, I guess, academically.
Right. And now all of a sudden you're the expert.
Well,
or the academic expert, anyway.
Oh my gosh! Well, it seems like you do get calls, you know, once you get a book out about something like that. But there are so many other people that you can learn so much from, and they're not necessarily, especially actually, they're not the academics. They're the people you get to go out and talk to, the culture bearers and the tradition bearers. So there's a place, I think, for everything. And what I enjoyed about all this is that I was able to kind of mix the two things together.
For audiences that are going to come to the Irish Fest, say, for the first time, and maybe hear Cape Breton music and Nova Scotian music for the first time, what would you suggest they listen for?
Well, I think you brought up a couple of good things. First of all, with regard to the fiddling and the accompaniment, it's great to take a listen to that piano style, which incorporates other elements from other musical genres. I think people will notice that. They'll notice anything from probably ragtime to jazz influence to maybe even a little bit of blues. But still, it's such a unique style to listen for. So that's one thing I'd recommend. There's some great songwriters as well that will be coming out, and also singers of Gaelic songs. And I think it's important to listen to those Gaelic songs too, because there's a connection, certainly rhythmically, between the way that people play those fiddles and those Gaelic songs you're going to hear. So, you know, one performer, for instance, that we were talking about earlier, just before we began speaking here on the air, was Mary Jane Lamond. She and Wendy McIsaac play some wonderful Gaelic-style fiddling and singing together, which sounds so good with the arrangements that they come up with. Other than that, I think people should appreciate the variety, because there is certainly much more to this Nova Scotian music at this festival that you're going to hear than just the fiddling.
Well, I'm sorry you're not going to be here to play, Glenn. It would be lovely if that were the case, but maybe we'll catch you the next time you're in town.
Well, hopefully so, yeah. I very much enjoyed my last trip to Milwaukee, so hopefully I'll be back.
I hope so, too. And thanks so much for talking with us this morning. I so appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome, Michael.
Glenn Graham is an accomplished fiddler, composer, and scholar of the Nova Scotian tradition. We're hearing him here with a track called E-Tunes. There's a link to more about him, his music, and his book on the Cape Breton fiddle at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Well, the spotlight of this year's Irish Fest may be on Nova Scotia, but that doesn't mean we won't hear music from Ireland as well. Coming up next, the duo Creel comes to Milwaukee by way of England, Ireland, and Disney World. Well, we'll explain that when we come back. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. And we're back, and it's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. All artists sacrifice for their art because, well, everyone has to eat. Actors make commercials, novelists write for popular magazines, and world-class Irish traditional musicians become the house band for a pub at Disney World. Yes, the one in Orlando. No, they don't have to wear the ears, and they say it's not a soul-killing gig. Really. They are UK-born fiddler Colin Farrell and Irish-born guitarist and singer Damian McCarthy. Individually, they've played and recorded with some of the giants in Celtic music. Together, they're Creel. On the heels of a newly released live CD, they'll perform at Irish Fest here all weekend. Colin has played here before, but it's Damian's first time to experience the festival. I reached them by Skype in Orlando. Gentlemen, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks very much for having us.
Thank you.
How did Creel form? How did you guys get together in the first place and then decide to be a duo?
Well, one night I met Colin in Limerick, where I'm from in Ireland, and he was studying a master's degree in the university there. They have a great traditional Irish music program. And I just met him at a party one night and we got talking. There were some good musicians, a lot of good musicians there that night, that Tony O'Connell, Desi Kelleher, lads like that that I've played with since. But we got in touch then and we put a few tours together. We did a tour of Europe and Colin was playing over here in America at a place called Raglan Road in downtown Disney. And he decided they were going to open another bar up in Kansas City. And he got the call to put a band together. And he called me. So that's pretty much it.
And so, Colin, for you, I mean, how did that happen that you were going to come to Kansas City?
Well, I was in Orlando. A friend of mine, an accordion player from Dublin, Peter Brown, put a band together. And I did that. And then I did it for a year. And then I left and joined Grada. And then I was on the road for a year and a half. It was tough at the time. I just bought a house in Florida and I was away all the time. I had to make a decision whether to stay touring or come back. And I was offered the job in Raglan Road at the Irish pub. So I decided to give Damien a call and we went up there for a year and a half. And now we're back down in Orlando for the last 4 or 5 years now.
So I have to ask what it's like to play at Disney World. I mean, I think my fear would be that the music would become Disneyfied as opposed to just being the music. Do you have any problems with that?
I know what you mean, but what we do is, I mean, it's a lot of requests. You know, that's what our aim is. Obviously, people are there on vacation. We have to give them the best time possible. We get asked to do a lot of songs, and that can range from, you know, the requests we get can range from Led Zeppelin to the Irish Rovers, you know. So we need to know, well, Damien knows hundreds of songs now, thousands of songs, just to cater for everybody. And it's great as well because we can play our own stuff. We write a lot ourselves, so we can do that. It's not strictly all, you know, the Wild Rover and Whiskey in the Jar, you know, but we do a lot of that stuff. But we can do what we want, really, which is nice.
That's a lovely thing when you're allowed to have that kind of freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah, we play the game, so they're kind of, you know, we know what people want, and they don't want to be educated in Disney at 6 o'clock in the evening when they're walking around, you know. They don't want to be, here's a song from the 1600s or something. They want to hear Whiskey in a Jar, and they want to clap along, and we do that early in the day, but the evening goes on, there's different stuff, and we like to play stuff from things we like as well, you know.
The only one thing about living down there, and which is why we're so excited about coming to Milwaukee as well, is there's not really much of a music scene. You know, there's no bands who ever pass through, or there's no sessions. That's the one big downfall about being down here. That's why we're looking forward to meeting up with a lot of friends in Milwaukee in the sessions and, you know, seeing a lot of different, all the great bands that are going to be there. So,
yes, and of course, as you know, the sessions happen after the regular stuff at the hotel, and you'll be playing all night if you want to.
Yeah, which I was looking to see if we had any early concerts, so we don't, so that's good. We should be all right. I was just worried about Damien going missing a couple of mornings.
And when do you actually arrive? Is it Friday?
Friday morning, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So you're here for the majority of the fest. So that's great.
A late flight on Monday, late as possible.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, you and everyone else, I think.
Yeah.
When you, you know, putting aside Disney for a second and, you know, and knowing what, you know, people are there on vacation and that sort of thing. But when you're working on your own stuff for yourself, when you're putting a show together, when you're thinking about a set list for a place like the Milwaukee Irish Fest, how do you approach it? What are you trying to do for an audience?
It's funny, really. We all just sat down there just before you came on. We were just writing a little set list out because, like I said, so many songs and tunes now that we do play. It's hard. The set in Milwaukee's probably only for an hour, so...
Yeah, we've been playing 4 hours a night for probably 5 years, you know, six nights a week. So we're going to be finished by the time we warm up.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's just to play, you know, a few songs that people do know themselves, and we just want to entertain people and make it as enjoyable as possible for them and ourselves as well. So, you know, play stuff we like.
We kind of have a bad history with set lists as well. We write them out, but we kind of rarely stick to them. But we're gonna try to write one out anyway.
Yeah, people sometimes shout up a song and then it just goes off somewhere else. Because at least I only wrote a list out just quickly then. There's about 50 tunes and songs on it. I'm like, we're not going to fit that in.
Not in an hour and 20 minutes, no.
No.
Not even as fast as we play.
We'll see how it goes with, you know, with any requests or tunes. But no, I'm looking forward to it. Because like I said, we haven't done too much because we're down here. We haven't had a chance to get away and do too many festivals. We've only done two or three in the last... probably 3 or 4 years. So that'd be nice.
Do you miss it, being out on the road?
Oh, big time, yeah. Well, you know, I was on the road for a year and a half, and grad at the time, they're away probably 10 months of the year. So you can overdo it a bit. Say, like, I'm married now, and Damien just had a baby last month as well.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much. He just got married. So, I mean, that's tough, but I do miss it. We're talking now about, you know, trying to get out a bit more again now, with the new album, you know. Even just in America, there's so many great festivals and great venues and gigs. You know, you don't have to be traveling overseas every couple of months. You know, just a couple of months here and there touring would be nice.
Do you miss being in the UK and Ireland?
Yeah, I'm used to it. But I still get back maybe twice a year to do some gigs. And we miss meeting up with friends and go to the different festivals. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, they were all down at Milltown Malby at the Willie Clancy Week. And we were hearing from everyone over there. And the Flyer at the end of the year in Derry this year, you know, it'd be nice to get back to it. Yeah. But, I mean...
miss the family and all those things, all right, the festivals, the music, the culture a little bit. But there's not a lot happening in Ireland as well for us at the moment for musicians. And I know from talking to my friends and stuff that there's not a lot of work there and there's not a lot happening. And it's, you know, as much as we miss it, we're probably better off down here, you know.
We both just got our green cards as well, so we're sort of settling in America as well. So, you know, we like it over here, you know. So probably gonna. It looks like we're going to stay for the foreseeable future anyway.
Well, I was going to say the UK and Ireland's loss is America's gain.
Thank you, buddy.
And, you know, I mean, with the people that you've played with, people like Michael McGoldrick, I know you've played with him, and there's such good bands and there's such good music and musicality happening in the scene. Like, it seems to be pushing forward all the time. I'm just worried that there aren't the venues and that musicians can't make a living.
Yeah. No, I mean, you have to go touring. It's funny, I was just talking to Michael. He's doing that Martin Offula tour at the moment round. He was just the second last day on a 4-month tour. He was in San Sebastian. He was just saying how much he was looking forward to getting home, you know, because it's a long stint, 4 months and that. But and that's one thing for being over here as well. You do miss out on some opportunities with the bands back home. You know, you get asked all the time, can you do this tour or, you know, which would be nice, but I don't know.
I think it'd be nice. We're set down here and we like living down here, but if we could get out, you know, next summer and maybe do, I don't know how many, 10 or 12 festivals or something and do what we're doing for the rest of the year where you wouldn't have to move and you could be with your family and stuff, I think it'd be a good balance.
And I couldn't believe as well when I did a tour around England and Scotland a couple of years and how many amazing theatres there was at different venues. The Irish music's actually, in England at the moment, it's very popular. There's so many festivals and great venues that are doing the music. It's very popular.
I think the trad scene really is, and then people like yourselves pushing it and turning it into not just hearkening back, but looking forward and finding either, I hate to use the word fusion because it's not necessarily that, but there seems to be a lot of interest in taking things forward and creating new traditions.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the same with ourselves as well. You know, we're always looking, you know, Damien writes a lot of songs, and it's funny. Some guy rang us up to use some of Damien's songs. Just as an example, he's a dancer, he's a DJ and a dance artist, and he wants to incorporate the Irish music into that.
Which is a big headache right now, but I'm trying to figure it out. But yeah, it's. I mean, you have to evolve, because, I mean, if we're all playing the same stuff all the time, it's going to get very boring and repetitive, you know? So you have guys like Mike out there pushing it just, you know, a little differently, and it's good, and people like it, you know?
And with the bands like Mumford & Sons and Lumineers and all that, that does have a folky, you know, a very folky feel about it.
It does, yeah.
And it seems to be incredibly popular.
Yeah, right now especially, yeah. You have acoustic guitars and videos on MTV now for the first time in, you know, probably 20 or 30 years with Mumford & Sons and the Lumineers and... You know, it's just good to see bands with guitars and stuff again, you know, and fiddles and...
MTV. Is MTV still a channel?
I don't even know.
I think it is, but I don't think they play music anymore.
Okay.
Yeah. So, well, when you guys get here, what are we... it's just the two of you. I know you've added a couple of fellows to play with you at some times, but it's just going to be the two of you here, right?
Yeah, the piano player went back to Ireland. He was just here for a year with his girlfriend. He moved back, and the drummer just recently moved to St. Louis. But they're going to be available to tour with us next year, I think, if we...
And our idea as well is for the bigger festivals is to bring in different musicians like Mike McGoldrick said he'd come over and do any festival if you ever need him. And John Joe Kelly is another lad we play with. He said he'd come over. So it'd be nice to bring... Because Mike and John Joe, and like John Joe was out a few times with Fluke, John Joe Kelly, but it'd be nice to bring them over. I don't think they've been in America enough, you know what I mean?
Oh, I agree. They have not. And I would be beating down doors to get to hear all of you guys play together. That would be amazing. Amazing. Yeah. I mean, I don't know that there's a better Boron player out there than John Joe.
No, it's incredible. Yeah. So, I mean, there is a lot of amazing Boron players at the moment. But yeah, John Joe is certainly special when the Boron. So.
He sure is. You have to let me know if you guys get this together, because I want you in the studio.
Maybe next year we'll do a big band.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. That would be fantastic. Well, Colin and Damien, I am so looking forward to hearing you when you're here in Milwaukee. And great to have you back, Colin and Damien. Welcome.
Thanks very much, Bonnie. We can't wait to get up there.
Thank you, Bonnie. See you soon.
Fiddler Colin Farrell and guitarist and singer Damien McCarthy are Creel. They're the house band for Raglan Road Pub at Disney World in Orlando. They'll be playing Irish Fest all weekend, beginning tomorrow night, and you can find a link to their schedule at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have three bands play for us in the studio. Scottish folk rock group Monron, a young Celtic funk trio from Sligo called JP Trio, and the Galician piper and flutist Carlos Nunez. So be sure to join us for all of that starting at 10 a.m. here on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining me for Lake Effect. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.